Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, it's a long way to Tipperary. Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today...
Yes, Joe?
We're going to be starting the first part of a two-part episode.
Yeah, this is a topic so big it could not be contained within a single show.
And no. Really, we just kept finding notes, like right before we came in here and sat down, we were like, oh no, there's more, there's so much more.
Well, it is a somewhat mind-bending topic.
Oh!
And quite epic in scope, it turns out. But so, to set the scene for what we're going to talk about today, I want to have a little mind experiment.
All right.
Okay.
Think of yourself.
No, easy.
I know it's easy for you, Jonathan. But who? I mean, think about what you think when you think of yourself. Uh-huh. There's sort of like a thing you have in your mind. It's your personality, your traits, the things that the ways you would describe yourself in your OkCupid profile. If you're being honest, I guess.
And if I'm no longer afraid of my wife.
Okay. But there's sort of a problem with playing this game because we like to think of ourselves as sort of dependable and unchanging.
Sure.
Like we are who we are, and we think each of our personalities is sort of one fixed eternal feature of the universe. Mm-hmm. There's Jonathan, and he's who Jonathan is. But deep down, we sort of all know it's not really like that, right? I mean, human thought and behavior is sometimes disturbingly malleable.
Yeah.
So to some extent, we can change what kinds of people we are. You can form new habits and break old ones. And experiences, you know, can change the way you would react in any given situation. We can take steps to change ourselves. And it's easy to see how, since we can change ourselves, we could probably also take steps to change other people.
Or have other people change us.
Exactly right. And so, like most other measurable phenomena in the world, deliberate methods of changing human thought and behavior are things that can be studied scientifically. And right now, we might not know a whole lot about this field, but we will probably know more and more as time goes on. So that brings me to today's topic, mind control.
Yeah.
Will it be a thing in the future? Is it a thing now?
Right.
How reliable will the science of controlling human thought and behavior become?
Right.
Is this a thing that's good or bad for humanity? I mean, obviously the sort of implication is that it's bad, but what are all the ways we could look at it?
Right.
And how's it going to play out?
Yeah, and this is something that I really enjoy reading about in science fiction because obviously, you know, there's so many novels that warn us against this kind of stuff, right?
And a lot of them are that really good dystopian sort of novel that's just so much fun to read.
Yeah.
Well, right, because that's the ultimate type of oppression that's imagined in these dystopian futures, right? It's not just that you are sort of physically constrained and imprisoned and threatened. It's that your very sense of self is threatened.
Yeah, yeah.
That the state changes who you are.
Right. It's that you're physically constrained and you're happy about it.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't know not to be happy about it or why you would ever be unhappy about it. Yeah, so just as some examples, as obviously anyone who has delved into science fiction would be aware of these, but Orwell's 1984 is a great example.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And this is set in a society that is so steeped in propaganda that its citizens are trained in the art of doublethink.
Yes, holding two contradictory thoughts at the same time. Also, doublethink.
And believing them both.
And doublethink actually has a couple different uses in the book. But, for example, you might be told that, let's say, that war means peace. That's a simple example. And in the classic sense of doublethink, not only would you think that war means peace, but that eventually the concept of war would completely change so that when you think the word war, you're thinking what of the concept peace. That takes on a brand new meaning and that it becomes the reality from that point forward. So really it's about how this despotic government really is defining reality and enforcing that reality among citizens. And if you don't play along, you get in trouble. And most people play along because, you know, that's what they're told to do. They're kind of just cogs in a wheel at that point. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's also a manufactured disparity between the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows, where there are very small percentage of people are a very, very small percentage of people are in the upper class, a slightly larger, but still pretty small percentage of people are in the middle class, and then everyone else. And the main character is in the upper class in a sense, like kind of he's in the middle class slash upper class area. And things do not go well for him. But then we also have Anthony Burgess's Clockwork Orange.
Right. So there you've got this kind of sense of at least seemingly benevolent mind control, right? It's implemented as a crime reduction initiative, essentially.
Yeah.
They take a young man who is, by all accounts, not a nice guy.
No, he is truly reprehensible.
Yeah.
But they do some techniques on him. I think it's a combination of drugs and then behavioral conditioning.
Yeah, it's aversion therapy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. to force him to have a very visceral negative reaction to any form of violence.
Yeah. Essentially all the things that he absolutely adored when he was on his own and could be the free-willing sociopath that he was have now turned into triggers to make him feel violently ill. Going so far as the music that he used to love, which is actually, that's kind of the breaking point for him, is not mm-hmm. so much the violence, as his inability to choose to be violent, but the music has been taken from him as well. And, what's interesting to me about this book is that the American version for the longest time left off the final chapter, chapter 21. So it ended with chapter 20 where the main character, Alex, regains his ability to make choices to be a terrible, terrible person. And so it's kind of left up to the reader to wonder whether or not it was better to remove his ability to choose to be evil, thus, you know, kind of removing part of his humanity. And that way he could not commit wrong. Or was it better to allow him the ability to commit wrong, knowing that that was a potential outcome?
That old question of whether without the capacity to do evil, anyone can ever truly be good.
Yeah. And yeah. So, chapter 21 negates that question. Chapter 21, Alex grows up, and essentially Burgess's point was kind of like, you know, people grow out of it. You know, you can be a sociopathic teenager, but eventually you mature and then you realize, oh, I was kind of a jerk. And so
I don't know if you grow out of just driving around murdering people.
That's what chapter 21 says.
Well, that's a nice thought.
Yeah,
it's why I mean,
one can hope.
I kind of prefer the one that does not have chapter 21 in it, because of that reason. And so then we've got Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, and the reason I group these three together is all three deal with a world in which the government is trying to impose a particular order in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, you've got a government that actually an entire society that has evolved to the point where everything is predetermined for everybody.
Yeah.
So as soon as you have a fertilized egg, then genetic tests determine where that fertilized egg is going to end up within that society, whether it will be in their caste system, whether it'll be in the upper castes or lower castes. Lower castes are actually genetically and chemically altered so that they have a limit to the amount of intelligence that they can have. Their physical capabilities are limited as well. And so it's a very restrictive world. And again, the character's journey is one of discovery about how the world that they didn't know was oppressive, how oppressive it actually was.
Yeah. So, the main characters in Brave New World, they might live a very sort of like placid and comfortable existence in mm-hmm. a way, but that it could be seen as without having the true vitality of life. And they sort of discover the romantic worldview.
Right. The passion of being able to completely mess yourself up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But of course, we don't have systems like this in the real world. I mean, you might get some people out there saying like, no, man, we're living in 1984. Come on. Open your eyes, sheeple.
Well,
we don't really have like full mind control methods bearing down on us, especially not ones that are deliberately controlled and studied. We have culture.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. one could, in fact, look at culture as an elaborate mind control method, but it's something that arose naturally out of, you know, just human behavior over hundreds of years, not a deliberate and scientifically informed attempt to control how people in various regions of the world would think.
That's right. What our vampire overlords want you to think, well, Joe.
And there's also, of course, the attempts to manipulate that culture, to actually leverage elements of that culture in order to get public opinion thinking one thing or another. So it's while it's true that the cultural element is certainly more prevalent than any kind of science fiction-y attempt to control people on an individual basis, that cultural element is something that not only are we aware of, but we try to exploit. And by we, I mean various
people. Humans. Yeah,
not just me.
No, there are whole fields of study outside of Jonathan Strickland that are devoted to figuring out, how to influence actions and decisions, either to make the stuff that we have more efficient for us to use or to, you know, profit businesses that want to sell us stuff.
Yep.
Or profit governments that want to sell us ideas.
Well, yep. Exactly right. I think that's one of the reasons that if you're looking at the most old-fashioned forms of mind control and sort of the science of influencing behavior and thought and emotion and opinion, one of the first places to look is advertising and propaganda.
Right.
Oh, sure.
And really the two are so hand-in-hand related. I mean, in many, many ways. So propaganda, we'll start with that. And that's defined as usually a biased or misleading information used to sway public opinion on a matter.
It's not necessarily misleading.
Like, could it be propaganda if it doesn't say any facts that aren't true?
It could certainly be propaganda by presenting true facts, but not presenting all the facts. I mean, propaganda.
But that's still misleading. Yeah.
It can't.
Yeah.
You could argue it's misleading, yes. And you could argue also that biased doesn't necessarily mean nefarious. But it does mean that there is, you know, you don't use propaganda for an unbiased reason. The bias is why the propaganda exists in the first place.
Yeah.
Right? You're selling an idea. And in order to do that, that means that you have a side already. Right? You're not like, war might or might not be good. You decide. That's not propaganda. Or at least not effective propaganda.
Wouldn't that be great if that was like how all the campaign commercials worked? Is it was like, you know, yeah. Here are some candidates. I don't know. Make up your own mind.
Now I want a
that
parallel.
That would be beautiful.
I think it'd be great to have a parallel universe where everything when it comes to public relations and propaganda and all that sort of stuff is just incredibly unbiased and mediocre. Just yeah. See how far that world gets along. At any rate, this idea has been around for a while, guys. It's not the word propaganda really got going in the early 20th century, but the concept of using this means of communicating to a people that have a common base of knowledge and a common set of interests dates back to ancient times.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at any ancient Mesopotamian carving or something, yeah. You know, like or depicting like one of the rulers of ancient Egypt mm-hmm. or something like that. It's propaganda. It's there show you how powerful and glorious this leader is.
Sure. And
it's not necessarily there to give you an accurate recounting of the facts of history.
Well, and to be fair, also, you know, you're not going to find this on a lot of civilizations that didn't have that common set of knowledge. If the peoples were scattered so much, then it just the communication to the people was something that was necessary for propaganda to work.
Right. Well, you don't need propaganda if you don't have a centralized body of government.
That's true. But you also don't need propaganda if you can't have propaganda if you can't directly in some way communicate with your people.
Right.
So ancient Greece is a great example. The Athenians were subjected to propaganda in things like theatrical productions or religious festivities. Also, even just athletic games, the things like the Olympics could become propaganda for Greece. but beyond the ancient world, you know, we get into kind of a more, I don't know, deliberate approach to propaganda than simply, hey, we're great, and those other guys over the hill over there, they're not so great. You get to the time of Philip II of Spain and Queen Elizabeth of England. They had a little propaganda war about a thing called the Spanish Armada.
Mm-hmm.
Spain was like, look how awesome our armada is, and never actually said, by the way, we were completely defeated in 1588. That totally, you know, they never acknowledged it in Spain at the time anyway. Whereas in England, in fact, I think it was Sir Walter Raleigh who later on wrote that he was disgusted by how Spain had presented the Spanish Armada to the Spanish population as if the defeat in 1588 had never happened.
Wow.
Whereas I'm thinking, like, you know, come on, Queen Elizabeth, she was pretty savvy on the ways of communicating to the English public as well. So,
oh, sure, yeah.
If it had gone the other way, I'm pretty sure
yeah.
the England would be like, oh, we totally don't. No, whatever. Yeah, it was a little tiff.
Would you argue that at some point, like Shakespeare was a propagandist?
You know, he certainly was in a way, because the reason he wrote the Scottish play was
we're not in theater. You can say.
All right. When he wrote the Thane of Cawdor's play, when he wrote Macbeth, he made sure to do a couple of things. First of all, that's when James I was now King of England.
He wanted to make his line look good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in the line of kings presentation in Macbeth, the last king was thought, at least in scholarship, to have held up a mirror and pointed it toward King James.
Wow.
To suggest that James himself is the descendant of this line
mm-hmm.
that ends up taking over for Macbeth. Also, the play was very short compared to most of Shakespeare's plays, partly, at least according to scholarship, due to the fact Shakespeare had heard that James I had a short attention span. And also it had witches in it, which James I was really interested in. So it, in many ways, it was propaganda.
Wait, I can't tell if you're kidding. Is this a known thing? James I was into witches?
He was into witches is probably the wrong way of putting it. He was very much against them.
Fascinated by them, yeah. Perhaps you could say.
Terrified, okay. Perhaps, is another way. I mean, of course, this is at the very early part of James I's reign.
He wasn't into witches like I'm into witches.
No, he wasn't watching The Craft at 2 a.m. every night.
Okay.
No, it's not like you, Joe.
Okay, sorry,
go
ahead. Oh,
man, I almost thought that James and I had something going there.
Yeah, well, so when we think of propaganda these days, obviously our opinions are very much influenced by what that meant in the first half of the 20th century,
yeah.
War I and II in Europe.
Yeah, Great Britain in particular forged the modern idea of propaganda during the early months of the Great War, as it was called then, or yeah. World War I as we know it now.
The war to end all wars, except it totally didn't.
Except yeah. it did not at all, yeah. the British government first cut off Germany's oceanic communication cables, meaning that they would lag behind in getting news and to like press and supporters over in the United States, mm-hmm. which was huge. And then in September of 1914, remember that war had only broken out in July of that year, the British government set up Wellington House, which was the secret organization that called upon journalists to write things that were sympathetic to the British cause and also published its own newspapers, eventually in 11 different languages with a circulation of like 500,000 copies per issue.
Wow.
Crazy amounts of stuff being put out there. The Chinese language version is credited by some historians as influencing public thought enough that China was able to declare war against Germany and not have a revolt on its hands.
Wow.
And the general idea of Wellington House was to create publications that seemed like they were grassroots, not governmental.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were published by local commercial publishers instead of government-owned presses. And the materials were circulated not by government officials, but by like local opinion makers.
Yeah, we see this come up again and again, not just in government propaganda, but in other means of trying to sway public opinion. And one of the big ones is, let's try and make sure it looks like it's coming from quote unquote real people.
Right.
And not a voice of authority. That way it doesn't seem authoritarian. It seems like a genuine upwelling support for whatever idea it happens to be.
It's like why, you know, an advertiser might want to give some of their stuff to a celebrity to wear instead of like having a spokesperson say, you should wear our product.
Yeah. If you give Michael Jordan your shoes, then suddenly kids will like the shoes.
Well, it
yeah.
looks like he's just authentically enjoying these shoes.
Which maybe he is. Maybe he's just holding the shoes up to his face and going, I really enjoy these.
Yeah. But that certainly is exploiting something that they perceived about the way we form opinions.
Yeah.
That they picked up on the fact that people are less likely to have their mind influenced by something that they recognize as coming from a government source.
Right. And you would still get information from government sources as well.
I mean, oh,
like
of course.
Things like posters, things and songs, all this kind of stuff that would be either sponsored by the government or promoted through the government. And that wasn't just in the UK. Over in the United States, we had our own version of the Wellington House. On April 13th, 1917, President Woodrow Wilson formed the Committee on Public Information.
Oh, that sounds so innocuous and boring.
It sounds,
I know, right?
To me, like it sounds like it almost is like two steps away from one of the departments in 1984.
Yeah, it really does.
The Committee on Public Information.
That would be called like the Committee for Public Truth.
Yeah.
Or something.
Which I said, two steps away.
Right.
So he put George Creel in charge, and Creel was a journalist. Some called him a muckraker. He was also a proponent of free speech. He said, you know, free speech was really important. And obviously censorship from public sources, like government sources, was completely wrong, and he disagreed with it. However, since he was then put in charge of this department, it became kind of his job to at least filter stuff, if not outright censor it. And in fact, there were quite a few times where they would tell people, like, you should really not publish this story. It would look bad. And they were trying to drum up, the government was trying to drum up support from the American public to get involved in World War I, which was not a popular idea at the time.
Oh, sure.
To send people overseas to fight someone else's war.
Yeah.
Which would become another issue during World War II. So part of it was this idea of let's publish the stories that are going to help support public opinion to get involved and downplay the ones that would not support it. And one of the things that came out about this is kind of the idea that we see over and over again with propaganda, which is if you can control the flow of information to a people so that they only get one side of the story, then obviously it's going to be easier for you to sway a public opinion in support of that. If they're not getting the full story, then any decision they make is going to be based upon a limited set of information.
Sure. That's ostensibly why countries like China don't allow full access to the internet.
Or North Korea, mm-hmm. which is probably, I would say North Korea's got this down pat with as far as propaganda goes.
Yeah, but one thing we can say about propaganda in this period and even a lot of propaganda today is that a lot of it is still not what I would call necessarily scientifically informed.
Right.
It's in a lot of cases, I don't think that they've researched like what would be the most effective way to get people to think the way I want them to think. They just kind of intuitively sense like you don't want people hearing bad things about the leadership.
Well, right.
What's funny is that a lot of research actually has gone into this, although from sources that would seem unusual. For example, one of the people who was working at the CPI was a guy by the name of Edward Bernays.
Ah.
Yeah, he was really good at making
people
thinking what he wanted them to think.
He was creepy good.
Well, I guess we should transition then to talking a little bit about Edward Bernays and maybe the overlap between propaganda and advertising, how that creates this mass mind control effect.
Yeah, so he was not just someone who worked in propaganda. He worked in public relations. You could argue that it's advertising, but really it was PR. His job, he saw it as he would be hired by companies to help them do whatever they did more effectively by convincing the public that whatever that company did was awesome.
Sure. He was born, let us say, in Vienna in 1891.
Yep.
Although his family did move to the United States when he was just a baby, I think.
He was like 1 year old.
And his uncle, interestingly enough, was one Sigmund Freud.
Yeah.
It's not that interesting. I mean, come on.
Sometimes an uncle is just an uncle. I saw where you were going a mile away, and I approve, sir. Yeah, so Freud, obviously, very influential to Bernays. Bernays was, so, depending upon whom you read, some people say, well, he was a genius because he was able to study psychology and sociology and then incorporate those ideas directly into a practical approach when it came to PR. Mm-hmm. Other people said, no, he was more of a guy who could just cut and paste cool ideas that a lot of other people had come up with and just put them together in a new format that was really effective. So again, in my mind, that's still genius.
Either way, he was real effective.
Yeah. So here's some stories about ways he was able to change public opinion. And the first one is probably the most famous that he's associated with, which was getting women to smoke in public, specifically Lucky Strike cigarettes. So Lucky Strike cigarettes had hired him saying, we want to sell more cigarettes. And he was looking around at the potential markets. And one large untapped market was females.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because, well, a couple reasons. One, the biggest one is the social stigma that was against women smoking in public.
Mm-hmm.
It was considered vulgar.
Sure, sure. And this, we should put in, was in the 1920s?
Yeah, yeah. And there's also, by the way, a series of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know videos that explains all of the things that Bernays got up to, which I highly recommend you check out. But the other issue, slightly more frivolous, I would say, is that the color green, which is what the Lucky Strikes packaging was, it was this dark green color, that it was not seen as fashionable, and therefore women were less likely to purchase them, even if they did see that smoking in public wasn't this stigmatized activity.
I don't quite get that. Well, there was a time when just green was out.
Yeah, it just was not a thing.
His
attack was multi-pronged. One of those was to get people to change their opinion about the color green, and so he started to chat with some of his buddies who were fashion designers, people who were designing fashions in France, and convincing them to add green into the fashion lines for the following season. So the Parisian fashions that were coming out were incorporating this color of green. So suddenly green was seen as a very fashionable color. But that still doesn't address the other problem, right? About women smoking in public.
Sure. But luckily there was this whole women's suffragette movement going on.
There was a whole women's lib thing, you know, that was picking up steam, and he thought, hey, I'm going to leverage this movement to work to my benefit. He ended up convincing several women who were involved in the women's liberation movement to organize a march while smoking Lucky Strike cigarettes as a way of saying it was like kind of an empowerment symbol, right? The idea that the women were the equals to men, that they could do the same things men could do, including smoking in public.
Yes, do what you want. Get cancer, whatever you want.
And they were even calling them torches for freedom.
Oh, my.
That's what the cigarettes were being referred to as. And this combination really helped swing things so that women were buying cigarettes and smoking in public. And you could argue that in part it helped change some public perception of women, but it got them smoking. So it's not like it's a win-win all around. But that's not the only thing he's responsible for. Like, there are other big things.
Like big cultural level things.
Well, yeah. Hold on. Are you saying Bernays is the reason that bacon isn't a sometimes food?
Bernays is the reason that I'm not saying he's the reason that bacon has now become an all the times food. That really has to do with Brooklyn, New York.
No, it has to do with bumper stickers and stupidity.
It started with hipsters and ended up kind of boiling out from there. So I'm going to the source there. But yeah, no, Bernays was, he was hired by a company that, among other things, produced bacon,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to be able to sell more bacon. So he ended up writing, as the Stuff They Don't Want You to Know episode says, a carefully worded letter to about 5,000 doctors asking what would be more healthy for people, a hearty breakfast or a light breakfast. As far as I know, he didn't actually use the word bacon in either of those. Then he said, he launched a public relations campaign that said 4,500 physicians agree that a hearty breakfast of bacon and eggs is best for you, and ended up in creating this market for bacon to become a breakfast food in the United States.
The reason that we eat bacon for breakfast here in the U.S. is Edward Bernays. That's it.
Yeah. So the things he started to do have become essentially the like to-do list for PR firms these days.
So he actually sort of had something approaching a more scientific methodology for figuring out how to change people's minds about, I don't know, what you eat for breakfast or when you should smoke cigarettes.
He was looking at things that that would tend to influence people and then try to leverage those. So for things like an expert opinion, that would be something that could end up influencing someone. So he would look for experts or spokespeople who would end up lending legitimacy to whatever claims he was making.
Right.
I'm sure you've seen those old commercials. Some of them are on YouTube now with more doctors smoke Camels, the healthier for your lungs.
It just makes me think that Bernays would have like run circles around Don Draper. I mean, it's just like there'd be no hope for Draper against Bernays.
And it was really so brilliant because he wasn't really marketing particular branded products or even particular brands. He was marketing opinions and feelings and urges and concepts.
Yeah, and he was creating word of mouth campaigns, which again goes back to what we were saying before with governments about the legitimacy seems to come from the fact that it's a grassroots approach as opposed to something that's top down. If it looks like it's bottom up, people tend to think, "Oh, well this is something that people really do care about, something I should care about one way or the other."
It's, I think, the same reason you see so many companies today trying to get like hashtags going on Twitter, like get people to participate. And why that's so often is just a miserable, embarrassing failure.
It's so crude. If you're lifting it up next to what Bernays was doing, because if you say to someone, "Hey, be interested in our product with this keyword," then you're ruining the entire experiment.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're showing your hand.
It's very rare when a brand can go out there and start using a hashtag effectively. It does happen, but it's far more common that we see these things rise up because maybe there are a couple of notable personalities who use it and then it spreads from there. Occasionally it's an event that happens and then something that is directly tied to that event becomes like the zeitgeist for whatever that is. Anyway, getting back to Bernays, he actually wrote a book about his methodology. He called it Crystallizing Public Opinion. It was reprinted back in, I think, 2011. But he comes across as a little condescending, essentially saying that the public are dumb and they need to be led. I mean, really, it is very much in that realm.
I mean, to be fair, we are pretty dumb.
What do we need to
be
led?
If I can just speak for myself.
Yeah. And I feel like if I were standing next to Edward Bernays, I would be like, "Man, I'm a moron. Crap."
I don't know that I'd feel dumb, but I would certainly be like, I'm not eating bacon anymore. Of course, I haven't eaten bacon in a long time anyway, but that's not the point. So, apart from that one day, but that was a slip. So then there was also the another book he wrote called Propaganda, in which he made the case for the manipulation of public opinion as a necessary component of democracy.
Of democracy.
Yeah,
huh.
That you can't have democracy unless you first tell the people what they need to vote on and why they need to vote that way.
Wow.
I'm oversimplifying.
No. But I totally believe that that's, okay.
That's a thing.
Well, yeah. you can look at it in a certain kind of way by saying, a democracy, if it is working properly, is only as good as its people. And if you have people in a properly functioning democracy who widely hold very bad opinions, then you're going to end up with very bad government.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a tricksy subject. So.
Yes. But Bernays was not the only person who was working in this kind of sticky ideological matter around those times. I wanted to talk for a moment about diamonds
And I know, because you love talking about diamonds.
I do. I do. If you have either watched Brain Stuff or listened to Stuff They Don't Want You to Know's podcast, then you may have heard me talk about diamonds before. But basically, so diamonds are the engagement ring stone of choice because of a marketing campaign created by De Beers, which is that cartel, if you so choose. You could say vertical diamond mining / accrediting / distribution corporation.
You could say monopoly.
You could say monopoly. Yeah. Any of those words are probably valid. Around the 1930s, the demand for diamonds was falling. They were seen as a luxury that the average person didn't need, and they were no longer a true rarity since the discovery of really huge deposits of them in South Africa. Only about 10% of engagement rings around that time bore diamonds. And so De Beers, which had all of these diamonds, was like, hey, NWA or ad agency, can you launch us a multimedia campaign that will push diamonds onto the fingers of some 75% of brides in the United States by the 2000s? That's actually probably not what they said, but that's what ended up happening. And we are not the only country where that occurred. Or, you know, back in the early days, there were fashion columns that were written by an agency representative that were not reported as being written by an agency representative that were pushing diamonds. They had these loaner programs to get jewelry onto the rich and the famous for big socialite events where these photographs would be published in newspapers, or whenever Marilyn Monroe was wearing diamonds in a movie, they were probably loaned to her from De Beers. Simultaneously, they started educating the public to increase the demand for more expensive diamonds. Those four C's are completely a De Beers NWA collaboration. Simultaneously, they were also propagating the idea that diamonds should never be resold. Thus, they were maintaining the demand for new diamonds. It's completely insidious. And if you would like to hear a very long history on that, well, not very long. I mean, it's long enough. It's long enough to cover the territory.
It's very thorough.
It's thorough. you can check out Stuff They Don't Want You to Know's podcast episode from February 17th of this year, being 2015.
It's a good podcast.
Thank you.
And thorough. Yes. Looking ahead, because now we've, obviously World War II propaganda was huge, and obviously we live in an era of advertising today where we are constantly surrounded by ads, whether it's in billboards or in video or in audio.
Or on our clothing or...
Yeah, it's everywhere, to the point where actually there are entire people whose jobs depend upon how can we get over advertising blindness, where people have developed an immunity to certain types of advertising. They just don't even, it doesn't even register with them anymore. Looking ahead, like, what's the future of propaganda? I found an interesting interview with a guy named Sean Gourley, who did a TED talk back in 2009 and has since talked about this a couple times. He's a data analysis expert and was talking about how in the future we'll see governments participate in propaganda through social media conversations, which makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We were just talking about how the approach of, making this a grassroots kind of approach benefits the adoption of certain ideas. And whether you're trying to sell, a line of clothing or sell the idea of a big political policy.
Oh, well, it totally makes sense. I mean, you will see politicians that, for example, have a Twitter account or a Facebook account. I mean, pretty much all of them do now, at least in the United States that I'm aware of. It's rare that you encounter a politician who doesn't have those things.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have followers, of course, who are people who they can count on to be ideologically and perhaps even just culturally or socially in line with them.
Sure.
And then they can selectively report the things they want to report on their feed on Facebook and say, like, hey, here's a news item that's flattering to me and the things I support. And then they know that their followers will share that with their friends and comment on it positively. It's a very productive venue, we might say.
Right. And it gets even creepier than that, because Gourley's point was that we can use data analysis to identify trends before they really take off. So let's say, for example, that, Lauren, you're a politician.
Sure.
And let's say that the data analysis has shown that there is a growing, but not huge, public opinion that is counter to your strategies. It's counter to your philosophy.
Oh, no. What am I going to do about it?
Through that analysis, you discover the best ways to create counter stories, to insert them into the conversation, and thus head this off before it becomes a big trend. So it's the same idea as creating counterintelligence or counterpropaganda that has dated back ever since we started talking about propaganda. But doing so on a scale that's much more precise, in the sense that you are you're detecting these things before they even become noticeable on a wide scale basis. So you're actually talking about using big data to examine things like public opinion and be able to try and influence it before it becomes like a conscious part of the public conversation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And because so much of our activity takes place on platforms that are largely public, not all of us do, obviously, but if you happen to have a publicly readable Twitter feed or a publicly readable Facebook page or some other social platform, then that information can be gleaned by a device that really, like a web crawler that's looking for keywords, to start doing things like data analysis to see what kind of opinions are coming up and how best to either encourage those opinions or suppress them.
You know, another thing I can see very much is personalized propaganda.
Like personalized advertising?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, much the same way that the ads you get on Facebook are determined by what some kind of algorithm has figured out you might be interested in.
Yeah, boy, are they way off too.
They can probably also figure. Yeah, I've gotten some really bizarre ones.
I've gotten some bizarre ones, and I've gotten some very sharp ones as well.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I'm sure that they'll be able to also figure out, hey, you know, we can do some tests and figure out that people who have these same seven interests that you do are much more strongly affected by X type of propaganda than by Y approach.
Sure. Yeah, it can be. You know, especially like they look at activity, let's take Facebook, for example, the things that you've hit like versus the things that you might have looked at, but you didn't really end up
engage further.
Yeah.
Sure.
Then that could end up giving more information. I mean, there's a lot of data there. I mean, just assuming that someone, let's just take Facebook itself, for example, let's say that Facebook actually looks at how long things typically stay in your view when you are active on Facebook.
Which they do.
They know which stories you are looking at versus which ones you're just scrolling past. They know how to serve that stuff up to you.
Yeah.
And thus
they know how long you're looking at your ex's profile.
They do. They know whether you've clicked through news articles.
Yep.
Clicked through two news articles, I should say.
And so this kind of stuff can shape how they present information to you. Everything from just making Facebook more effective, which you could argue is, oh, well, that's okay, because we want whatever we're using to be the best experience possible, to presenting the kinds of stuff you are most likely to act upon in an advertising capacity. So the ways that Facebook would make money, you know, the fact that you would be more likely to click on this stuff, that which, depending on your point of view, either benefits everyone or is super creepy. Right? Because it either means that you are going to not waste your time on stuff that doesn't matter to you, and maybe you'll discover things that actually do matter to you. But on the other hand, it's like, well, Facebook's telling me what I should like. Now, ideally, I know that I'm always going to be encountering propaganda, advertising, etc. I'm never going to avoid that. I mean, it's not like that's going to go away. I don't think we're going to have a future where magically everyone says, you know what, I'm not going to try to get people to do the things I would like them to do. That's
sure.
Just, that's not going to happen.
No, so, not unless you go, you know, totally off the grid.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. If I end up getting a log cabin someplace and just cut ties with everybody, which I don't think I could do. I'm not good at chopping wood. So the key here is that you want to get as much access to as many different sources of information as possible, knowing that everyone has their agenda, even if it's something like their agenda is to try and create an unbiased, objective approach. We're human, so sometimes that just doesn't happen, and not even on a conscious basis. But our ability to access as many different sources of information as possible at least gives us the opportunity to have as close to an objective view as possible. So that's something that some of us have the luxury of because we live in a place where we can have unrestricted access to information.
And we furthermore have the type of lifestyle that allows us to spend time perusing that sort of information.
Exactly. So we're doubly privileged in that sense. But then you also have to take into account that human beings can be really lazy. And since we're lazy, then it means that we also have a responsibility to overcome that laziness and seek this stuff out. Because it's just as possible to have a society, a culture that has free access to all this stuff, at least on a, you know, on one level, like a hypothetical level, but through practice, no one bothers to do it. And so you end up, you don't have to worry about them accessing multiple sources of information. You can send out whatever messages you want. So, just something to keep in mind. I think most of our listeners are probably the type who goes seeking information from as many sources as possible just to, you know, get a really good view of what's happening. It doesn't mean that you agree with all of them or any of them, even. Mm-hmm.
I would be disturbed if you agreed with information from all of your sources.
Yeah.
That would be back to doublethink again. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think we're pretty much wrapping it up for this first part here. But you should definitely tune in next time, because next time we're going to get into the crazy territory of persuasive technology, moral enhancement. When is it maybe right to use mind control?
What color makes you do things?
Yes, all of that and more in our next episode. And yeah, it's some really interesting stuff that I did not know before I started researching for these episodes about what specifically people are doing to use these, our modern technologies, to propagate propaganda.
Yeah, and to just, in some cases, just try to make the world a better place. But that kind of approach is...
Whose idea of better?
Yeah, yeah, you know, not all pigs are equal.
Wait, what?
I guess all pigs are equal, but some are more equal than others.
Some are more equal than others. Yeah. Yeah.
Which,
there you go.
You know,
different Orwell. Yeah. Same idea.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. What? That wasn't in 1984? What about bacon? Okay, I'm getting confused.
Or, well, if you want to get in touch with us, you can.
That's where I was going to go. Yeah, you can let us know. You can send us an email. Our address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or drop us a line on Facebook, on Twitter, or on Google+. At Twitter and Google+, we are fwthinking. Just search fwthinking on Facebook. We'll pop up. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, you got comments, you got questions, send those to us. We look forward to hearing from you, and you'll hear from us again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.